Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, January 27, 2020. 10 people were killed in deadly communal violence in Tonj State.
Crisis, it is now under control. The government of Tonj State has sent huge forces, security apparatus, and they have de-escalated the crisis.
And women in South Africa say marriage is not the end game.
I'm seeing a lot of Brad Pitts and Angelina Jolie. Basically, we just prefer living together, starting a family if we want to. If we don't want to, it's okay as well. The old version of marriage from the older couples I've seen is outdated.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in Tonj State say at least 10 people were killed and dozens of others injured over the weekend in a land dispute that turned into communal clashes. Tonj State Information Minister says the state dispatched security forces to restore calm in the area. Dengai Deng has more for VOA from Bor.
Tonj State Information Minister William Wall says the deadly clashes erupted between Mok, Jawir, and Tonj communities in Wangalel County on Friday evening and continued throughout the weekend.
One person was killed and the fighting continued from that incident. It didn't stop until 10 people were reported to be killed and number of people were wounded.
Wall says several people were injured during the fighting but not seeking treatment because they are afraid the police will arrest them.
The injured people are not shown. Because, you know, they file our people here, our communities, they fear to show up their wounded people. Because they are saying maybe they would be the root cause or suspect of the conflict. So they don't show up their wounded people to the government.
The information minister says CAM has returned to Wangalel County after security forces intervened.
Crisis, it is now under control. The government of Tonj State has sent huge forces, security apparatus, and they have de-escalated the clashes.
The Bishop of Catholic Diocese of Tambura Yambio, Eduardo Iboro Kusala, has condemned the clashes in Tonj State. He says most of the conflicts among young people are caused by the fact that a majority of people do not have jobs.
The government needs to come in. The institutions are very good at that. They can help the community to map that area and see what are the needs, what are the resources available, and those resources will be turned into income activities. Yeah, of course, that would have to do away with the laziness. The problem here again, of course, we sit and tell a lot of stories which do not give us food. And here I tell people, you hold the Bible in one hand and hold the hell in another hand.
Bishop Kusala says the church should do more to educate South Sudanese about the value of life. Revenge killings are all too common among pastoralists across South Sudan. The government implemented several disarmament exercises in Tonj, but weapons still find their way back into the hands of young men. In November last year, clashes between the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and armed young men left 12 soldiers dead in Namagok County in Tonj State. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng, reporting from Bor.
A generation ago, sisters Luendo and Chipo might have been considered anomalies. Both are close to their 30s and neither are married, but they are part of a national and global trend. In recent years, South Africa has seen a rise in marriage age. The median age for first-timers is 32 for women, up from 35 years ago. The sisters, who were raised in a religious home where marriage was the norm, say they don't see their unmarried status as a big deal. VOA's Anita Powell meets with Johannesburg's growing ranks of women who don't need anyone to put a ring on their fingers.
Samina Anwari, a freelance content creator, is 33 and plans to wed in December. She says marriage was never a big deal to her, and she was surprised at the reaction she received when she broke the news.
I mean, I've graduated and I've gotten jobs, I've gotten all these things, but like when I told people I was getting married, that is the most excited I've ever seen them. I actually burst out laughing when they got like that excited, because I was like, but I haven't really achieved anything.
For young professionals like 32-year-old Luendo Hamukoma, a bookseller, marriage is not a top priority. Her parents have been married for more than 3 decades, but that's not a life she necessarily sees for herself.
You finish school, you get married, you have kids. This is a successful life. I, on the other hand, completely different life. Go to school, figure out, find a job that, you know, can pay you a living wage or that kind of stuff, and then just kind of start figuring out how to be a good version of yourself. Marriage was not on the cards.
But coming to that conclusion has been a process, Hamukoma says. She says her family's strong faith made marriage seem essential.
And, you know, when you're very Christian, one of the big life accomplishments is marriage, your spouse. But realizing that you can't marry yourself and that, you know, this requires meeting someone who you think is worth your time and worth, you know, building a life with. If I haven't met that person and I'm 32, I shouldn't be miserable either.
Psychologist Inkobile Olivia Adranoi, who specializes in couples therapy, says she's seeing a lot of indifference to marriage. And it makes sense, she says. The key to a happy marriage, therapists say, is open, honest communication. The traditional subservient model of marriage, in which a wife defers to her husband, doesn't leave room for that.
I'm seeing a lot of Brad Pitts and Angelina Jolie. Basically, we just prefer living together, starting a family if we want to. If we don't want to, it's okay as well. The old version of marriage from the older couples I've seen is outdated, because now I'm seeing older women who are saying, I don't feel like I'm listened to. I don't feel like you hear anything that I say. So it was always there. It was just suppressed.
Price comparison website Priceonomics crunched global marriage data and found one clear correlation. The higher the country's income, the later the age of marriage. Hamukoma's younger sister, Chipo, an economist who is also not married, says she has seen similar data in Southern Africa, and that marriage for marriage's sake doesn't make logical sense.
As an economist, the statistics for married women, that your health goes down, your pay goes down, your stress goes up, your unhappiness goes up. Empirically, there doesn't seem to be much of a case, because single women are like statistically happier and wealthier. So it's like, it has to be a really good marriage.
Incidentally, Anwari plans to keep her surname after her wedding. She says her fiancé sees her the way she sees herself, as a partner, not as property. And she says that's how many of her peers see it. Marriage is no longer the goal, but happiness is. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Nearly 4 months after elections, the North African country of Tunisia still awaits for its next government to take office. When that happens, it faces daunting challenges. The economy is shaky, but in the capital's Medina area, some traders are struggling for manpower. From Tunis, Lisa Brand reports on an effort to save them, which may offer bigger lessons for the country.
Historically, the Medina was the heart of trade and craft and art, and it's structured with many souks. Every souk is an alley or a street that is dedicated to a specific craft.
Leila Bengasemi is giving a visitor a brief history of Tunis's centuries-old Medina as she walks through its winding streets and describes each souk or bazaar.
So you have Souk Shawashin, where all the Shashia artisans are lined up one after the other. You have the Souk of Souk Nhas. It's the coppersmith souk. And it was also the heart of the government.
Bengasem is not a tourist guide. She's a social entrepreneur. On this day, she's concentrating on another old craft as she visits the Medina's last bookbinder. 64-year-old Mohamed Ben Sessi shows some of the books he's restoring. There's a magnificent old Quran with blue and gold engraved pages. Bookbinding was not part of his family's tradition, but he fell in love with it 4 decades ago.
Il y a des demandes, mais l'offre et la publicité.
The new generation is less enamored. Vincessi says there's still demand for bookbinders, but young people aren't interested in joining the trade. He's not the only artisan looking for skilled labor. In parts of the country, up to one-third of young Tunisians are unemployed. But here in the Medina, some venerated old trades risk going extinct, partly for lack of manpower. Bin Gassam says these trades are part of Tunisia's history and very identity.
I don't imagine a Tunisian family with that does not have a... an artisan. I mean, my mother, she embroidered most of what we use today in the house.
But now the country's traditional arts and crafts are under threat for a myriad of reasons. Tunisia's sinking economy and currency have made quality raw materials unaffordable for some craftsmen who have switched to more inexpensive options that cheapen the final product. Bin Gassam believes restoring artisanry's one central place means a broader rethink of one key economic driver.
We're not promoting Tunisia with all its wealth. And so far, I don't feel we have communicated the best story. I think we communicated the easiest story.
Tourists have long flocked to Tunisia's beaches. For many, exploring the country's cultural patrimony is secondary. A spiderweb of cobblestone streets and whitewashed houses, the Medina was founded in the 7th century. Today, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It was restored under hardline president Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, then suffered under the 2011 revolution that ousted him.
C'était un peu ça la stratégie de l'association sauvegarde la Medina.
Architect Souled Aoudidi works for the Medina Preservation Association. The goal, she says, is not just to preserve the Medina's buildings, but also the people who live here.
Everything you see here is original. The tiles, the marble, the ironwork.
That's also Bin Gassam's goal. She's transformed two ancient buildings into boutique hotels and hired local residents to run them.
All our suppliers are micro-businesses around us, and I think if investments are inclusive and pay attention to shared economy, then maybe the whole community will grow together.
Bin Gassam's shared economy mission is bigger than her two hotels.
In the 100 hectares central Medina, we still have today 525 artisan production workshops. Of course, this is a lot less than what it used to be. In fact, in the last 50 years, maybe the number went down to half.
She organizes workshops for her hotel guests featuring local artisans like bookbinder Vincessi. It's one way tourists can appreciate and buy into these traditional crafts, one way to help preserve them.
Hello.
Bin Gassam also works with Mohamed Troudi. At 28 years old, he's the Medina's youngest manufacturer of Tunisia's famous flat-top Sheshia hats that are in demand in North and Sub-Saharan Africa.
Ouais, vous voyez, maman, le gars, il veut pas travailler.
Troudi shows a visitor his calloused hands. He says young people don't want to work. They want an office job with a computer, Facebook, and a morning coffee break.
Le vieux devant moi. Après, son fils, il veut pas
he points
travailler.
To a fellow Sheshia maker across the street. See that old man, he says? His son doesn't want to work in the trade. Troudi is afraid that one day the shop will close for good. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Tunis.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Zimbabweans pay a lot of money for a new passport. That story is coming up next after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there something about yourself that you would like to change?
Definitely not. No, because at least I know my life has been good. I've not been entertaining bad company. So to change my life, I need to start making at least new friends again.
Life is all about learning. We learn every day. So in as much as we are still breathing, there are things we need to shed off.
Currently, I would like to change my tummy. I'm growing a pot belly. So I'm exercising. I've bought an abdomen machine that's helping me to deal with it. And I want to lose weight, probably 5-8 kilos.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Zimbabweans in diaspora who cannot afford to apply for a new passport in hard currency have been urged to travel home to process the document. The Zimbabwean government charges its citizens in the diaspora $318 for a new passport, and low-income earners in Botswana say this fee is beyond their reach. Nkundisi Dube reports for VOA from Gaborone, Botswana.
Most Zimbabweans in Botswana survive on low-income jobs like farm or housework and say they cannot afford to pay $318 for a new passport. Zimbabwe's ambassador to Botswana, Badirai Mkonoeshuro, recently asked his government to introduce different pricing tiers for passports. He says this could help the low-income earners who cannot afford to pay the new application fee.
So we are making representatives through our Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade to the Registrar General's Office and Home Affairs to say, can they also cater for the other lower tier diasporans who can afford passports at a lower rate, even if they are to be charged in US dollars.
The Zimbabwean government, however, this week said if its national outside the country cannot afford to pay the US dollar fee, they are free to travel home. In Zimbabwe, passport fees are in the local bond notes. But some Zimbabweans, like Mary Mutiniri, who works as a health helper in Botswana, say it is still costly to travel.
If our government says we must travel back home, do they really consider the cost and the distance that we have to travel? In any case, we have to be away from work for days, as it takes time to process a passport in Zimbabwe. It's not a one-day process.
Some of the immigrants say reducing the fees at embassies is the solution, but Harare authorities argue the country needs the foreign currency to procure the material used to print passports. Ambassador Mkonoeshuro says since the process of getting a new passport in Zimbabwe is cumbersome, travelers should be allowed to use temporary travel documents in the meantime. It takes up to a year to get a new passport in Zimbabwe.
We are also talking with the authorities to say because of the challenges at the RG's office, can they accept the temporary travel documents, or TTDs, for people to travel in and out while they are waiting for the processing of their passports?
Without passports, hundreds of Zimbabweans continue to illegally cross into Botswana in search of employment. The neighboring country deports more than 1,000 Zimbabweans who enter illegally every month. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
Still on Zimbabwe, more than 4 months after most Zimbabwe's public hospital doctors stopped going to work to protest low pay, normalcy is returning to hospitals. Zimbabwe's richest man, Strive Masiwa, intervened in the situation. Hosea Zanvashi has details from Harare.
Most doctors in public hospitals said their salaries are too meagre for them to be able to afford transport to work, and they stopped going. Negotiations between doctors and the government have dragged on, with no resolution in sight. But a foundation founded by Zimbabwe telecommunications tycoon Strive Masiwa has made an offer to encourage doctors to work. Dr. Tawanda Zwakada is with the Zimbabwe Hospitals Doctors Association.
But from what we've seen, is that they are offering a monthly remuneration, more of a fellowship, training, scholarship. Because amongst the doctors, there are some who are still in training, some who have finished training.
The offer by the Higher Life Foundation pays the equivalent of $200 in local currency, which will add to the salary the government pays. Some doctors initially resisted the offer, arguing their pay should come from their employer, the government. Zakada, however, says many have returned to work.
The situation on the ground has improved. Doctors are returning to work, mostly because of this latest development of the Higher Life Foundation. It gives us some relief and some capacity to return back to work, whilst we still continue to look for other long-lasting solution to our challenges as doctors.
He adds that doctors remain hopeful the talks with government will continue and bring a permanent solution.
We've always been open for dialogue with the employer, but of late the employer has left the dialogue table. We don't know why. He's just decided to shun dialogue with the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association. So as of this year, there hasn't been any talks with the ministry or the health service board. But as the ZHD, we will remain open for negotiations with the employer and even other developmental partners.
The Higher Life Foundation Fellowship Program is set to run for 6 months and then be reviewed. Zakada says there's still a lot to be done in terms of sundries and quality up-to-date equipment in hospitals. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
A Malawian High Court has ordered public schools to accept students with dreadlocks after an 8-year-old girl was barred from classes because of her hair. The Blantyre Girl Primary School in September said the girl would have to cut her hair in line with the school policies or else she would not be allowed in class. The court said banning students over their hair was denying them their rights to education. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Rastafarian Feniambewe was upset when the Blantyre Girls Primary School refused to enroll her daughter, Makeda Mbewe, because of her hair. The school said the girl's dreadlocks were against a policy requiring students to have their hair shorter trimmed. So Mbewe took the school to court and won. Malawi's High Court this month ordered all public schools to allow students with dreadlocks. She says, "We are very much excited because in this battle, we were not fighting for Makeda alone, but all other children who attend back from school. The problem was widespread." Malawi's High Court also ordered the school to give Mbewe extra classes to make up for those she missed. Rastafarianism is an Abrahamic religion from Jamaica that stresses living what they regard as naturally, including with hair. Jerifaya Pomea is the chairman for Rastafarians in southern Malawi.
In our religion, they say every Rasta have to keep dreadlocks. When you go to the number 6 in the book of the Bible, the number 6 says, if you want to work full-time the works of the Most High as a Nazarite, you have to keep your dreadlocks, you have to keep your hair grow.
Malawi's Rastafarians have long been sidelined by education policy requiring students to cut their hair to promote uniformity in school. Some Rastafarian parents chose private schools, while others like Deborah Habakuk gave in and cut their children's dreadlocks. She says, "When I took my children to a public school, they refused to enroll them until they cut their dreadlocks. I tried to find an alternative, but I failed. So instead, I trimmed their hair so that they should get an education." The High Court ruling means Rastafarian parents will no longer have to choose between their religious practice for sending their children to public school. Malawi's education authorities refused to talk to a reporter on the matter and have until February 4 to appeal the High Court's order. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
That report by Lamek from Blanta brings us to the end of our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Fitinaya Nini by Black Boogie. We have been listening to Black Boogie with the song Fitinaya Nini. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Kupitina yanini, kupitina marafiki zako, kupitina yanini, kupitina watu zawatu.